This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Hello, everybody. This hour of Janet Mefford Today brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation. The fully animated story of the first Christmas, told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star in theaters November 17th, rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com. Well, I want to kick things off today with some great news and a big thank you. You have heard me talking for the last several weeks about our campaign with the great ministry Heart for Lebanon, and this is a wonderful effort that has helped a number of children who have been refugees over in Lebanon get to the Hope Centers that are run by Heart for Lebanon. This is where they can get meals and they can get a Christian education and hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we had a goal of providing 61 safe classrooms at Heart for Lebanon's Hope Center, a whole classroom full of kids where these children can be attended to and hear the gospel. And we are so happy and thankful to report that we were actually able to provide 74 days at the Hope Center. So we want to say a big thank you, because we could not have done it without your generosity and your willingness to share the love of Jesus Christ with these children you've never met. And someday in heaven, when those who have come to know the Lord finally get to say thank you to you, it'll be a wonderful day. And I just want to mention, you can learn more at heartforlebanon.org. And if you missed the opportunity to give, you can donate there as well. That is heartforlebanon.org. And I just want to say once again, God bless you. And thanks so much for helping to turn despair to hope. We are really, really grateful for our great Janet Mefford Today listeners. All right, let's turn our attention for a moment to the pro-life issue. This is going to be great. If indicators are any showing of what's coming, we're really excited about it. The FBI, according to The Hill, has now asked the Senate for unredacted documents that it obtained from abortion providers, signaling that agents may be investigating whether Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers illegally sold fetal tissue and body parts. And that's good. The request was just made in the last few days to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa is the chairman. He had last referred Planned Parenthood and several other abortion providers to the FBI for investigation after a lengthy probe into the transfers of fetal tissue. Grassley had said at the time that his committee had uncovered enough evidence in its final investigative report to show that abortion providers had transferred tissue and body parts from aborted babies to firms for use in research by charging dollar amounts above their actual costs. And of course, you remember all of those videos from the Center for Medical Progress, the great undercover pro-life work that was done by David DeLeiden and Susan Merritt, and the great folks over at CMP. Now maybe something is going to happen. Abortion providers, they went on to say, are allowed under a 1993 law to transfer fetal tissue for research at a cost equal to the price of obtaining it, but they aren't allowed to sell it at a profit. A spokesman for the FBI did not immediately respond to a request for comment. No shock there. Planned Parenthood said, while it is aware of Grassley's prior request for a criminal probe, none of its affiliates has had any contact with the FBI. And they defended themselves, of course. Baseless attacks, widely discredited, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's so funny about this. Fusion GPS, which is this firm that's been so much in the headlines over its involvement being hired by the DNC and the Clinton campaign to come up with this fake Russia dossier against the Trump campaign. Fusion GPS is the same firm that Planned Parenthood hired in order to discredit the Center for Medical Progress videos. So they seem to major in misinformation over at Fusion GPS, because those videos, which Fusion GPS said were selectively edited and therefore not actually reflecting the truth, they were absolutely wrong about that. And you might recall that Alliance Defending Freedom came back with a legitimate report showing that, yes, in fact, these videos were absolutely in context, weren't edited, no problem there. But this is really important, and it really is indicative of perhaps a new era for the Justice Department under U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, that finally there may be some charges brought against Planned Parenthood. I will never forget, as long as I live, some of those undercover videos, what they revealed about these ghoulish human beings, if you even want to call them that. There probably are worse things we could come up with to describe them. But the one woman who said, oh, yeah, I want a Lamborghini. Come on, give me more body parts. I don't know how anybody gets to that point in their humanity where they think like that. It's demonized. There's nothing else you can really say. You have to be demonized to be able to deal like that. It's like something out of Hitler's era. It's like Dr. Mengele. I don't know how anybody can fall into that and sleep at night. It's just amazing to me. But, you know, it goes on. And there's another story out, which I found quite interesting. Just in recent days, the New York Times, of course, ran an op-ed. This is just incredible to me. What they're upset about in this op-ed by Rosalind Warren is the fact that Facebook is giving so much ink, I guess, as it were, if you want to say that about the internet, to pro-life websites. And the whole thrust of this article is to make sure that pro-life websites are declared fake news and Facebook silence the fake news. Now, what is this fake news? You can read it for yourself if you go on the New York Times website. Not that I recommend reading it, because I'm sure you have better things to do, like clean out your sock drawer. But that's why I'm here, so I can bring you all of this nonsense in one little small quantity so you don't have to waste your time. But anyway, this woman goes on to say that she exposes the fact that Life News has been reporting things and Live Action has been reporting things. She talks about one particular article that talks about partial birth abortion, in which a doctor jams scissors into the baby's skull and the child's brains are sucked out. She puts that in quotes, even though that's actually true. And she says, don't let these lies kill another child in such a horrific manner, is the end of the piece. And she says the article was engaged with at least 1.1 million times, making it the most shared article about abortion on Facebook last year. Last week, the company's general counsel appeared before Congress alongside his counterparts from Twitter and Google to testify on the company's role in distributing misinformation ahead of the 2016 election. Facebook says it's taking fake news seriously. It has a label for disputed stories, brought in independent fact-checking partners, and allows users to report false articles. It's not clear whether these attempts to tackle misinformation will work. Critics have called them ineffective and slow, but there's another problem, too. So far, Facebook and the public have focused almost solely on politics and Russian interference in the election. What they haven't addressed is the vast amount of misinformation and unevidenced stories about reproductive rights, science, and health. Now, listen to this line. She says, evidence-based, credible articles about abortion from reputable news outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post didn't make it to the top of the list of most shared articles on Facebook last year. Okay, so basically she's all upset because in droves people are listening to the pro-life information and clicking on it and sharing it and retweeting it on Twitter or sharing it on Facebook with their friends and their family members. And the New York Times is losing its market share on the abortion narrative that they want to put out, which is pro-abortion. Same with the Washington Post. We're losing ground. That's what they don't like, because she really doesn't get into this piece on anything in detail having to do with fake news. What's the fake news? Partial birth abortion is putting a scissors in a baby's skull. That's what happens during a partial birth abortion. They do not want pro-lifers to reach the public. And this is just another sign of the desperation that the pro-abortion crowd feels. You have a millennial generation that is way more pro-life than the previous generation. They are losing the war on abortion, and they are desperate. It's why Planned Parenthood goes after David Dilaiden and Susan Merritt, and they file charges and file lawsuits and try to make lives absolutely miserable for anybody who comes up against them. But they're losing. That's the bottom line. They're losing, and people are hearing the truth. And thanks to social media, they're hearing the truth in larger and larger doses every day. And praise God. Praise God, because that's how you change culture, is you get the word out and you tell people the truth. And it's interesting, when the New York Times is all rattled, what can you say? What can you possibly say? Maybe people just aren't in the mood to buy your lies anymore, New York Times. Could that be it? When we come back, Kristen Hawkins with us from Students for Life, and she's going to talk a little bit about what pro-lifers are facing on college campuses. Don't go away. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
Friends, we must thank God for Ambassador Nikki Haley's steadfast leadership at the United Nations. Her commitment to freedom and justice around the world is having a lasting impact. In a recent speech, she discussed the future of the United States in the Human Rights Council and highlighted some of the many anti-Israel actions that call into question the Human Rights Council's judgment. She noted, since its creation, the Council has passed more than 70 resolutions targeting Israel. It has passed just 7 on Iran. This relentless, pathological campaign against a country that actually has a strong human rights records makes a mockery, not of Israel, but of the Council itself.
Join us on the front lines. Fight to defend critical issues like support for Israel and religious freedom. Together, we'll bring biblical constitutional values back to our nation. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to give today. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is John's story.
When our daughter Emma was born, my wife and I took a hard look at our finances for the first time, and we didn't like what we saw. My wife suggested that I call Trinity. Immediately when I spoke with the counselor for the first time, she was very helpful and put us on a plan for success. Right away, we knew we'd called the right place. We just want everyone out there who might be in our situation to know that there's help.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. Back on Janet Mefford Today. Well, we are seeing a lot of anti-free speech, anti-Trump sentiment out there right now from radical groups like Antifa. But one of the most disturbing developments on college campuses all over the country is that pro-abortion activists and their allies have also launched a full frontal assault on pro-lifers' right to free speech, including even vandalism and threats of physical violence. So we're going to find out more now on what's going on with Kristen Hawkins, who is president of Students for Life of America. Kristen, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, you've said there is actually a pattern of abuse that you guys have been observing. Tell us what's been going on.
Sure. Well, we've seen, you know, over the years, we've had vandalizations that happen on college campuses and Students for Life group, chalks, you know, facts about abortion, or 1-800 numbers for helplines or pregnancy centers. But what we've actually seen is since the election of President Trump, the rate of those vandalism cases has continued to skyrocket. And it's something that now is sadly becoming pretty routine for our Students for Life groups across the country. Last week, we put out an interactive map just detailing just the vandalism cases that we've, you know, written about in the past few years. And we're going to be asking our Students for Life groups to fill in this map with other cases, because sadly, these cases aren't isolated. That with the rise of Antifa, and really just this sentiment across the country with those who disagree with President Trump, those who didn't vote for him, they've kind of almost run out of things to do. They're just so, you can see in their faces on campuses when they come up and yell at us, or they don't know how to handle themselves emotionally and how to deal with this. And so they've just started resorting to violence, sadly.
It's terrible. Tell us some of the things that have been going on. As you mentioned before, you've got this map of vandalizations against pro-life speech that have been going on since 2012. And you mentioned before that since the election of Donald Trump, those have ratcheted up a little bit. What sorts of things have the pro-lifers experienced? What sorts of acts of vandalism have occurred?
Well, you know, we always have discrimination issues on campuses where schools will, you know, suddenly forget about the groups application to start a Students for Life group or the event hosting form. But these types of vandalizations are mostly done by other students or teachers. We just won a case this Friday in Fresno State where this May, a university professor took his students home class and encouraged them to go and wipe off the sidewalk chalk that the Students Alive group had put, that they had actually gotten permission to put on the campus, that talked about pregnancy center helpline numbers and how women who are pregnant are strong enough to be mothers and students. And we got this professor actually on tape arguing with our students, telling them that, you know, they might have had free speech to write what they wrote in sidewalk chalk, but he had free speech to erase it. And that was his free speech rights. And we actually won that lawsuit on Friday. The professor's in order to pay $17,000. He'll have to undergo a 2 to 3 hour First Amendment seminar training with our attorney. And so, you know, you see it from the professors. We also see from students, other students coming out with buckets of water to erase the sidewalk chalk or their own sidewalk chalk, trying to change the words or cross out what our students write, tearing down flyers. Had across the slate at Northern Kentucky University for the 11th year in a row, the crosses were vandalized. At St. Louis University in Missouri, the Cemetery of Innocents crosses were vandalized, the crosses representing children that were being killed every day from abortion. Miami University of Ohio, we had a human rights display, just a big poster board up where students came, ripped down our signs right in front of us and fled the scene. And so what we've been asking a lot of these cases is, you know, the university administrations will say that what the students are doing is wrong, but they don't actually police it. They don't enforce it. And so a lot of these schools, you know, we know we have their security footage there of the students, and we've been asking the schools to prosecute these students, to punish them, to show them that this behavior is never acceptable on college campus.
Right. Well, that's probably one of the most disturbing things when you're talking about this lawsuit that you've been involved in and just one against this situation with a professor. It's bad enough when you have pro-abortion students who are involved in this sort of thing. Yeah. They're young and, you know, you kind of expect some of that sometimes. But for the faculty to either get behind it or get involved in it or stay silent when it's taking place, that creates a real hostile environment for students who dare to go against the pro-abortion narrative, which is just outrageous to me when I think about it.
That's exactly right. And sadly, I mentioned Northern Kentucky University. The first year our crosses were vandalized, it was once again, it was a professor who had took her women's studies class out and was with her students ripping up the crosses. And she was disciplined by the school and actually ordered to donate money to the Pregnancy Resource Center and the community for reparations. It kind of sets this standard at the school, if the professors are involved in the vandalization, that this is okay, that this is acceptable behavior, and this is how you handle opposing viewpoints. And we know that's not true. I mean, you look back in 2008, 2012, the election of President Obama, you didn't have Students for Life groups going across the country vandalizing Planned Parenthood displays or stealing their literature. Our students know how to engage, and they know how to have discussions. Yeah. And sadly, that's what's missing on the other side these days.
Yeah, well, one of the things that was kind of disturbing that you put up was a faculty member who teaches apparently a couple of courses at San Jose State University. He actually put up something of a threat. I mean, this is a faculty member. Tell us a little bit about that, maybe an edited version of what he said.
Sure, I was just wondering how I was going to do that. This professor went to his Facebook page and used multiple curse words to describe pro-lifers and advocated violence against them, saying that somebody should go beat them up with a lot of expletives in the middle there.
Right.
And this is just, yes, these professors have First Amendment speech rights. They have the right to say whatever they want to say on their Facebook page or their Twitter, but there are consequences, especially in the workplace. That First Amendment doesn't really apply when you're talking about an employee-employer situation. And that's why we went public with this story, because he should be disciplined. He's creating a hostile learning environment for those pro-life students at the San Jose campus.
Absolutely. That's really nuts. So what are you advising your pro-life students across the country to do about all this? Certainly, you've been involved, as you mentioned before, in appropriate legal action at times. But what can be done? It's got to be very frustrating to try to get the pro-life message out and come up against this on so many different campuses. What can the students do about it?
Yeah, there's a lot of things they can do. One of the first things we tell them is contact us immediately. We have regional coordinators throughout the country. So every student for life group we work with knows who the regional coordinator is. So contact the regional coordinator, know, text or via email and tell us what's happening. Take photos, take videos of when it's happening. Contact us immediately. We assess the situation from there, and in certain cases, we'll go straight to our attorneys. The Lions Defending Freedom is a wonderful organization that we work with on our college campuses, our high school campuses. We work with the Thomas More Legal Society, and we will go straight to these attorneys if we feel like there's a legal case there, if their rights have been violated, if the school has failed to prosecute the vandals. And so the main thing is we just tell these students, you have to contact us, because so often I find when I visit students' life groups across the country, when I'm speaking on campuses, I'll take them out to dinner, out to coffee, and we'll be talking about what's happening. And they're like, oh, yeah, this happened to us, or it took us 12 months to get approved. And I look at them and I say, do you understand? Your rights have been violated. They wouldn't have treated a Planned Parenthood group like this. Right. They wouldn't have treated a pro-abortion group like this or an LGBT group like that. Right. And that's when students go, oh, man, I wish I would have known. I wish we would have told you. So that's number one of the things to say. If you feel like something's not right, you feel like your school isn't standing up for you, to call us right away.
Good. That's good advice. Well, and I know that you're in the midst of an Ivy League tour, right? You're exposing the lies of feminism. How is that going when you go out and about and you start going to these campuses where pro-lifers aren't traditionally receiving the red carpet rollout? What's it like for you?
You know, it's been really interesting. We are going to several college campuses. I'm actually in San Diego today on our Planned Parenthood, talking to Planned Parenthood bus tour, but then I'm leaving here tonight, heading to Kansas on my speaking tour. And, you know, the tour is pretty provocative. It's called The Lies of Feminist Power. I talk about the lies of mainstream feminism and how the second wave of feminism was really duped into believing that abortion and birth control on demand and all these things that are bad for women's bodies that kill innocent human beings are essential to women's equality. And so it definitely stirs up a lot of discussion. I had a great Q&A at Harvard last week that we showed live on our Facebook page. At Dartmouth last week, I had a bunch of protesters come out. My son and I were there, and we were escorted out to our car with security just to be safe. Dartmouth was probably the most hostile situation we've been in such a way where the students weren't, the students had never really heard of pro-life defense. They never really heard why somebody against abortion. And they were just, they were just shocked by what I had to say and talking about abortion, talking about the betrayal and psycho corruption of Planned Parenthood. And so for many of them, they really weren't there to hear me out. They just wanted to yell and scream. But we were able to have some good discussion.
That's really great. Well, and those are the places you need to go, right? Where they actually have never heard a pro-life message. That's exactly where pro-lifers need to be.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these are the discussions that we always look at this as planting a seed. It's very rare you're talking to somebody about abortion and they say, oh, my goodness, you're absolutely right. I've been wrong all these years. what you do is you plant the seed. If you plant that seed of truth, and you never know who's going to water or when it's going to be watered, but you do get that information out there.
Yeah, exactly. You never know how that seed will eventually take root and bloom. And that's why it's so important for pro-lifers to be where you are, Kristen, and doing what you're doing. And it's just really encouraging to know that pro-lifers are having such a strong presence on college campuses. And again, as Kristen mentioned, if you're a pro-lifer and you're on a college campus and experiencing some of the things we've been talking about, you can check out studentsforlife.org and get more information and stay in touch. Kristen Hawkins, thanks so much for being with us, Kristen, from Students for Life of America. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. While we're often told that Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species has definitively settled the question of how life on Earth developed, But now there is a revolutionary approach to the study of origins that has the potential for an impact as big as Darwin's. As my next guest puts it, the answer to the origin of species can be uncovered for the first time right now. So today we are joined by Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson. He holds a PhD in cell and developmental biology from Harvard. And since 2009, he has been actively researching the origin of species, both at the Institute for Creation Research and at Answers in Genesis. His new book is called Replacing Darwin, The New Origin of Species, and it's just great to welcome you here, Dr. Jeanson. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on your show, Janet.
Thank you. All right. So you make the claim in this book that the events of the last 130 years have rewritten the history of life on this planet. What is that all about? How is that the case?
Well, if you think back over the history of this debate, if Darwin hadn't written this book, if he hadn't tried to tackle that question about species, I don't think we'd have the cultural divide that we have today. We'd be living in a very different world. And the contention of my book is that the progress of science in multiple fields over the century and a half since he wrote that has changed our understanding. It's given us new tools to investigate this question, and it leads to a very different conclusion than what he proposed in 1859.
Right. So we've got the Bible telling us that God created all kinds of creatures, but we have Darwin proposing that all species evolved from either one or maybe a few common ancestors. What about the paradigm now has shifted so as to cast doubt on his theory?
I make several contentions in the book. One of the first is, when he wrote his book, he took a really an unprecedented scientific risk. He tried to answer a fundamentally genetic question before anyone had genetic data with which to answer it. It's basically like trying to discuss anatomy and physiology of the human body before anyone ever cracked open a cadaver. And you can look at the consequences of that over the last several hundred years.
Yeah.
You look at early history of medicine, and it's a disaster.
Right.
And species are defined by their traits, but traits are defined by inheritance, and inheritance is defined by, and Darwin couldn't have completed that sentence in 1859. No one had any idea what defined inheritance or what defined species. We now can, 100 years later. DNA was discovered as the substance of heredity, the thing that defines genetics, the field of genetics. And so Darwin was trying to answer and uncover how these genetically defined entities arose without any direct scientific data with which to answer it. So that's the point that I think has been largely lost in the contemporary debate, or perhaps minimized, and we've been arguing really about indirect data, fossils, anatomy and physiology, these sorts of things, which don't directly record inheritance. They don't directly tell you who is related to whom. They can't directly underscore Darwin's claim that everything on this planet is related.
Yeah, so you're talking in the book about a puzzle, as it were. That's kind of your metaphor for explaining some of the new paradigm shifting that's going on, it's specifically related to genetics. And this is not my area of expertise by the longest of shots, but on a layman's level, can you explain to us what we have learned now in the scientific field about genetics that has changed the picture from what Darwin had in his own day?
One of the biggest bombshells, I think, in the field of genetics is that this field actually records time, that there exists within every species, within every person, a clock of sorts that measures how long a species, a lineage has been in existence. So there's within me, within you, within every other person, this DNA clock that measures how long humans as a species have been alive on this planet. We've just begun to measure the rates at which these ticks of the clock occur. And so basically the ticks are mistakes. Every generation, DNA is copied, passed on to the next generation. DNA is what tells the embryo, you know, two arms, two legs, 10 fingers, 10 toes, that sort of thing. And that information is passed on ever so slightly imperfectly. And so every little bit of mistake that's added each generation accumulates over time. And so you can add up these and say, okay, are there a lot of mistakes? Are there a few mistakes? How long has this clock been ticking? And the bottom line is there's far too few mistakes for species to have arisen from one universal common ancestor for billions of years. And the flip side of this is we have good evidence that is perfectly consistent with a 6,000-year time scale, and that has a ripple effect across multiple scientific disciplines.
Wow. So let me see if I can understand this. When you're talking about the clock, the time clock, how long we know now, how long species have actually been in existence, how do you determine that? How do you figure out from a human DNA strand or what have you, what the time sequence is? How do you do that? How do you figure out how long some species has been in existence?
In principle, it's really straightforward. Practically, it gets a little complicated. So the principle is basically you find two genealogically related people. So it might be a mother and a daughter, father, son, grandfather, grandson. You get the DNA sequence of the parent or grandparent. You get the DNA sequence of the child or grandchild. And then you just compare them. And because so few differences happen each generation, it's fairly easy then to spot, oh, here's a difference, you know, the same, this is a match, and then there's mismatch, that sort of thing. The challenge is there's 6 billion DNA letters to sort through every generation to find these. So it is really the proverbial needle in the haystack. But with modern technology, this sort of experiment has been done multiple times on many different, let's say, mother-daughter pairs, father-son pairs, and we have a good sense of the rate at which mistakes happen. Again, it's a tiny fraction, not even 0.1%. It's less than that of all our DNA. And so then what you do is, once you have that rate, the rate at which this clock ticks, let's say 80 mistakes per generation or 10 mistakes per generation or one mistake every 6 generations, whatever the number might be, you say, okay, now let's get the total number of differences in the global human population, which is, again, a fairly straightforward thing to do. Because we are all 99.9% genetically identical, it's really easy then to say, okay, these DNA between these two people, that matches, here's a mismatch. And so then you've got your rate, you've got the total number of differences around the globe, and again, it's 0.1%, and you say, well, how long does that take then to produce the differences that we see? Does it take 6,000 years? Does this clock have to go over 100 generations, 200 generations, 300,000 generations? Does it go back to humans and chimpanzees? That's the sort of math you would perform with those sorts of numbers in hand.
I see. So this gives you a handle then on how much time has passed.
Yes. And so you compare what the scriptural time scale would be, 6,000 years, to, let's say, the human-chimpanzee split time, according to evolution, 6 million years, and you've got a 1,000-fold difference. And so the predictions of each time scale are dramatically different, and it's fairly easy then to say, okay, there's very few differences, or there's a whole lot of differences. And the bottom line, not just in humans, but in a handful of these other species in which we've been able to get that rate of, you know, mother to daughter, father to son, that sort of mistake rate, DNA mistake rate. In every case we've looked now, the answer is the same. There's far too few differences for these guys, these species, these individuals have been around for millions of years, but just exactly the right amount if species and humans have been around for only 6,000.
That's fascinating. So if I go into my local natural museum of natural history, what have you, and they're talking about millions and millions of years ago, it seems the genetic evidence would severely challenge that, given what you're saying.
Yes, and not just on for the reasons I mentioned. There's a second reason that I think really throws the whole geologic paradigm into question. That whole paradigm, when they throw out 65 million years for when the dinosaurs died out, they're using counting methods in geology that assume the rates we measure today, let's say the rate at which the Colorado River erodes the Grand Canyon, they assume that rate has always been the same times past.
Right.
And young Earth creationists have said, well, wouldn't a global flood have changed that dramatically, that rate? And they've just basically dismissed it. Well, here now we have a genetic argument for a recent time scale, and it uses the exact same assumptions that evolutionists have been using in the fields of geology. So now it calls into question not just the conclusions, but the entire foundational assumptions of these fields. And that's what I think makes this such a bombshell.
Well, it really is. That's fascinating. Yeah, and one of the things I want to get into when we come back from this break is some of these questions pertaining to the flood, because the flood obviously is extremely significant when you're looking at the history of the world. And for modern scientists to just say we don't believe the Bible and the flood never occurred changes everything. So I want to get into that in a little bit more detail. We're going to come back with Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson, his book, Replacing Darwin, The New Origin of Species. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation present The Star, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. Bo the donkey and his stable of animal friends follow the star to become some unlikely heroes.
That light, that's the star. This is where it's been leading me.
What's his name?
His name is Jesus.
The Star, in theaters November 17th. More information is available at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. We are back on Janet Mefford today. My guest, Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson, who holds a PhD in cell and developmental biology from Harvard University, and he has been actively researching the origin of species, both at the Institute for Creation Research and also at Answers in Genesis since 2009. He's out with a new book. It's called Replacing Darwin, The New Origin of Species, and I find this just fascinating, all of this genetic evidence that's coming out. And you mentioned before, Dr. Jeanson, we went to the break, you were talking about some other evidence that challenges the assumption of millions of years, which is really necessary for the theory of evolution to even work. You talked, for example, about the Colorado River and how, for example, when it erodes the Grand Canyon, there's assumptions on the parts of these evolutionary-based scientists that this has always occurred at the same rate. How does the flood interfere with the pattern, for example, of the Colorado River? Explain that a little bit.
Let's step back for a minute and think scripturally why we might expect this to be true. You go to Genesis 6 to 9, God says, I'm sending a global flood, and he promises to never do it again.
Right.
So by definition, we have to say what happened back then is different from what's happening today, because God promised it would be. He'd never send a flood like that again.
Right.
And so we're basically forced to start with that assumption. And if there was a global flood, what would you expect to see, basically, geologically? And you think about a whole globe inundated with water, tsunamis, tidal waves, these sorts of things, that's going to re-sculpt, reshape the Earth's surface in a huge way. If you just go to Google Earth and you look at the whole Earth and see if you can, from the whole globe view, pick out the Grand Canyon, it's just a tiny little crack in the Earth's surface.
Right.
And then you think about the whole globe being inundated with water and continent-wide waves or whatever may have been there. This can do a massive amount of erosion, cut much bigger canyons, erode statewide, continent-wide levels of rock very quickly. So it would, and the evolutionists know this. They know that if you have a global flood, this is going to dramatically change clocks. It's going to dramatically change how we understand geology. That's why they reject it from the start and say, we don't even want to deal with that.
Right, but isn't there solid geological evidence that, in fact, there was a flood?
Yes. You think about, again, thinking back to Google Earth and to astronomy even, what's planet Earth? The blue planet, for good reason, because 70% of the Earth's surface is still covered with water. People ask, if there was a flood, where'd all the water go? And it was actually Darwin's contemporary, his competitor, so to speak, Alfred Russel Wallace, who made the observation that the oceans are deeper than the mountains are high. In other words, if you were to bulldoze all the mountain ranges in the world, the Himalayas, the Rockies, so forth, had this gigantic bulldozer, shoved them into the ocean basins, so that the whole surface of the earth was smooth, no valleys, no hills, and any of that sort of thing. If you were able to do that, the globe would still be covered with water to a depth of 1.7 miles. So the floodwaters are still here, which if anyone was looking for evidence of a flood, you'd think water was the place to start.
Yeah.
That's one evidence. The extent of the geologic layers, some of them are continent-wide, and you think of cause and effect. The effect is continent-wide. Well, that kind of implies a pretty big continent-wide cause.
Mm-hmm.
You can find soft tissue in the rock layers. The evidence goes on and on. You can find specific fossils that defy slow and gradual burial. An ichthyosaur, an extinct marine reptile that is in the middle of giving birth, a fish buried in the middle of eating another fish, these sorts of snapshot-type fossils, to me, all point towards and require some sort of catastrophic, massive burial that is exactly what you'd expect to find from a global flood.
Wow, that is fascinating. What about animals? I know that you deal with this in your book quite a bit. The process of breeding, as you say, has produced a large number of breeds in a very short amount of time. I think this ties in a little bit to what we were talking about earlier. But this was a big, you know, thing that Darwin focused on was animals. And we talk about monkeys and joke around. We evolved from monkeys and that sort of thing. But in practical terms, what is the current situation with animal breeding, species and subspecies that casts doubt on the theory of evolution?
And let me back up on this one, too, just to deal with it. Something I've recognized that most evolutionists don't know. Many of them are still stuck in 1859 and think that modern creationists believe that God creates every single species in its current location, unrelated, yeah, unchanging, that sort of thing, when in fact, if you start with the scriptures, you have God creating kinds of creatures, and as a general rule of thumb, this is not species, this is not genus as a classification level, but probably level of family. So lions to house cats, all part of the same family, probably part of the same kind. Noah takes two of every kind on board the ark, not species. So he's probably taking two representatives of the cat family, which means then the 30-plus species of cats, lions, tigers, ocelots, pumas, lynxes, bobcats, so forth, all those have arisen since the flood. And some of the evolutionists, you know, most of them I think are unaware of this, but some of them have said, well, how is that feasible? How can you get that much species formation in such a short amount of time? And I think the answer really comes from Darwin himself. He made an analogy, and this is really the foundation of the evolutionary argument. He tried to make an analogy between the process of breeding and the number of breeds and the process of speciation. So you think of all the different horse breeds, Clydesdales, ponies, you know, the speckled coat colors, brown, the different types of coat colors, the hair length. There's just tremendous variety in breeds. We know these have a common ancestor because we're the ones responsible for producing them. And Darwin made an argument saying, well, you know, if you can get that much variety in breeds, why not the same amount of variety in species? What I've done in the book is to say, well, let's take that same argument. There's, you know, and to put numbers on this, we've got 700 plus breeds of horses. In the horse family, which I would say all part of the same kind, you've got seven species, three species of zebras, three species of asses, and one species of horse. If 700 breeds by the evolutionist's own timescale can arise in just a few thousand years, well, then surely species can as well, just seven species. The evolutionists stretch that timescale over 4 million years. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And the argument I've just laid out basically follows the structure and logic of the first two chapters of Darwin's book. So even before I, in the book, get into the genetic arguments for recent origin of species, I start with what Darwin himself said and say, let's take a second look. And you can make an argument from his own work, his own pen, basically, that species must have formed quickly, and all we have to do is look at the farm.
That's so fascinating. What do some evolutionists, committed evolutionists, think of this idea, what you're bringing forward about the genetic evidence and the stuff that we're now learning that Darwin had no handle on back in his own day? Are they willing to capitulate on some of these points, or what has been the reaction in the scientific community to some of these, you know, discoveries that have occurred?
I guess there's been two reactions. On one hand, evolutionists have, if you look at textbooks, for example, evolutionists have basically adopted Darwin's original arguments virtually unchanged. So the types of arguments he made from anatomical comparisons, the types of arguments he made from fossil record, the types of arguments he made from so-called vestigial organs or non-functional elements of our body, they're now repeating the same type of argument just with genetic examples. So in one sense, nothing has changed on the evolutionary front, virtually nothing. They're just accommodating whatever comes out in this existing paradigm. On the other hand, I think a lot of what I lay out in the book is new, especially the latter half is basically research I've been working on the last 8 years, and I think most are not aware of it. And so my second thought is, I think we'll have to wait and see. When Darwin published his book, he was in a situation similar to what creationists find today. 97% of the scientific community rejects creation view, or I should say they accept evolution. Darwin even had to address this fact in his day, knowing that the entire scientific community was against him. He preemptively asked the question, why does everyone basically, all the eminent living naturalists and geologists reject my view? And he gave four responses. Well, 10 years later, the 1869 edition of his work, that sentence changed. He kept updating his book, and he said, why, until recently, have nearly all the most eminent living naturalists and geologists rejected my views? So within 10 years, Darwin was able to completely change the scientific consensus, and that's sort of the time scale I have in my mind. I don't think this book has gotten enough publicity yet for the community to take notice, and my hope is that if they do and approach it with an open mind, they'll see a lot of things that challenge what they accept as fact.
Yes, and in all of these things that you outline in the book, what do you think is, if you can reduce it down to one main thing, can it be that one thing you've outlined in your book is more significant or the most significant to changing the game on accepting evolutionary theory, given all the stuff we've been talking about, genetics and species and so forth? Is there one particular point that you think rises above the rest as the strongest point?
Yes. If I had to condense really the biggest strength of the book into one sentence, it's sort of a mouthful sentence, but I'd say that the modern creation science views are meeting the gold standard of science better than evolutionists are, and they're doing so in the most important field of science on the question of the origin of species.
Wow. Well,
so this is a bombshell, I think.
It really is. People are going to have to read it. Again, the name of the book is Replacing Darwin, The New Origin of Species by Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson, who's been kind enough to join us. So good to have you here, Dr. Jeanson. Great work, and it was great to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you, Janet.
All right. God bless. Thank you again. Replacing Darwin, the name of the book. Thank you for joining us on Janet Mefford today. God bless you. We'll see you next time.